Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, the show where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and their careers, the events and songs that led them to be where and who they are today. I'm proud to say my guest is Velvet's co-founder, bassist and viola player, Mr. John Cale. John has had a remarkable life. Born in Carmarthenshire, Wales, his prestigious talent for music soon propelled him to pursue classical music in London, where his love of the avant-garde soon developed into an obsession. Under the patronage of legendary US composer Aaron Copland, he travelled to New York, where he embraced the city's potent experimental music and art scene, joining with Lou Reed and forming the Velvet Underground in 1965. Here John talks about the band's short but massively influential career and his emergence as a producer, working with artists including Patti Smith, The Stooges and The Happy Mondays. He also talks about his solo career, which runs right up to the present day, with the release of his new, characteristically unique-sounding album, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. And I started by asking John, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I just remember the time my uncle brought us a radio, and it was a turntable on top as well. It was really exciting. And he brought the radio, and it was a shortwave radio, and I started listening to symphony orchestras on the radio. And that's. But then at the same time, you could listen to Voice of America, Willis Conover.
Time for jazz. Willis Conover in Washington, D.C., with the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
And get a really all the American jazz you wanted, a Radio Moscow, and you could get all the Moscow Radio Symphony Orchestra. It was great growing up from about 8 to about 14, just listening to foreign countries on the radio and wishing you were there because it was dark and rainy in Wales.
And what about the first kind of musical experience that you had where you kind of thought, this is something I can do? Because you learned to play the violin and became very good.
The piano was really the one that pointed out to me that here was the music was a communication system that was really a lot easier to deal with than other communication systems such as English language and Welsh language. So, yeah, it opened up a lot because I used whatever facilities there were. There was a local library, you could go and order books and records. And I filled out these forms every day. I'd find another record I wanted to listen to, and they'd send it off, and it usually ended up in Marylebone Public Library, which had a huge record collection. So if I wanted to hear any new music, like Schoenberg or Webern, they would inevitably, and if they didn't have it, they would get it, which was just like Christmas every day, you know. Like,
so what sort of thing, what were your obsessions then early on?
You know, Varese, John Cage, and Berio, Stockhausen. I was interested in the personnel, like reading a jazz record, who's playing bass, and, you know. So who's the viola player on this?
When you first moved to London, did it feel like there was a kind of a mix of the avant-garde and the classical and maybe the kind of nascent pop scene all happening at the same time?
The pop scene didn't come in London. I didn't know about the Stones playing down in Barnes. I was in SE 14 and I was proselytizing about modern music, basically, and got viola lessons from Gwyn Edwards, and I just charged around town like a kid in a candy store, you know, grabbing people and saying, what do you think of this? Trying to figure out how to make music and the avant-garde work and make sense out of it. And
so you did move to New York. How does someone that was obsessed and very driven by minimalist music and the avant-garde find themselves bringing that discipline to a kind of rock and roll band? How does that happen?
The Beatles. I mean, the Beatle Revolution happened smack in the middle of it. And then I suddenly realised, hey, I've been missing out on my puberty all this time.
You say you want a revolution. Evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
In 1964, you met and first started working with Lamont Young, the American avant-garde composer, forming what was kind of your first band.
These guys were kind of crazy in their own way. They were great. They had a small room of the size, like with a four-track in it, and a tambourine. And they detuned the guitar all to a B and made this enormous roar of a noise and a riff, you know, and off they went. What happened was that the guy who was writing this stuff had other songs that he thought were really, you know, that he'd written that he thought had literary qualities. But then it suddenly became clear that he'd also improvise, you know, at the drop of a hat about anything, like what had happened that day, you know, and it was really astounding. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, I'm really getting tired of this avant-garde stuff. I mean, let's see if we can combine this and make it into something that we could give Bob Dylan a run for his money. And actually, although I'm proud of what happened with Lamont and how we lasted a year and a half of 3-hour rehearsals every day for a year and a half. Oh. You know, it was so arcane, and I was much happier in rock and roll.
What were those first Velvet shows like?
Messy. I mean, you know, you didn't. You had one mic. They happen in gyms. Most of these shows that people, the banana song happened, and she came out and she did the banana banner.
So you were supporting Shirley Ellis, a pop singer, at these gigs.
Shirley, Shirley, Bo Burley, banana banner, Bo Burley, fee fi, Mo Merley, Shirley.
And she came out and did this in front of high schools all over the East Coast because it was a hit on the radio and she could get all these kids in. But they had a PA system in these gyms and stuff. And so we opened for her and, you know, get the usual acerbic comics. The thing was that you couldn't get a gig in a club unless you played at least 3 top 10 hits that were recognizable. And we said, we're not going to do that. So until the point where we came with Black Angel's Death Song once and the owner said, you play that song again and you're fired. So we played it again.
Myriad choices of his fate set themselves out upon a platform to choose. What had he to lose? Not a coast, bloody country, all covered with sleep, where the Black Angel did weep. Not an old city street in the east. Gone to choose.
That first album, I mean, it's become almost a sort of totemic, unassailable piece of rock history now. Did you have a very, very clear agenda of what you wanted to achieve with it?
Yeah, I knew for me, the most important thing to do was to do something that nobody else could imitate. And that's something that's really a disease that you get from the avant-garde, that you cannot do anything that is remotely similar to what anybody else is doing. So, you know, once we detuned the guitars so that nobody really could play the riff unless you had this guitar tuning, and put the viola in so the sound was different and all of that. So when we came to the arrangement of Venus in First, I had a really good gut feeling that this was, I mean, it really created space in a different way on with the instruments that we had, and it was very effective.
Shiny leather in the dark. await you. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Severin, speak so slightly. Severin, down on your bended knee. Taste the whip in love not given lightly. Taste the whip, now bleed for me. Colors made of tears. Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of love.
Did you feel like you're in uncharted waters a little bit? Because it has. It's become this idea of the world that you immerse yourself in. There was the Andy Warhol's factory and the overlap between art and music and pop and the avant garde and experimenting. Did it feel like we're out on a limb here? I don't think, you know, was that a feeling at the time?
Yeah, in more ways than one. Yeah, I was watching it from the point of view of the downtown avant garde scene and Lamont and everything else. And I knew. Andy, I was aware of, there was a lot of suspicion between Lamont and Andy because Lamont was into repetition. And when Andy had the Coke bottles, I mean, he said, wait a minute, whose idea is, you see how bad it gets? Yeah. what was really more important was that he had an uncanny ability of finding combinations that really sounded astonishingly bad and then became astonishingly good. You know, they put in Nico in the band, for instance, was like everybody went, what? You know, but the image of the band shifted. All of a sudden, you've got this figure on stage, this gorgeous ice blonde, and all of us in black. Generally, when we play on stage, and our backs on the audience, except when we're singing, of course. But and you know, when I was looking at some of these old pictures, for instance, I was looking at the stage because there were pictures taken during the shows, and I was trying to figure out where the PA was. So all the voices went into the guitar amps, the guitars are into the guitar amps, and you know, you broke as many speakers as you could pay for.
Down to my toes. All white light I sit now.
When you left the band, can you remember thinking, okay, this is as far as I want to go with this. I'm ready to try something new.
Yeah, I was driven because I wanted to be a producer, and Nico was the one who really popped up as a very good candidate for it. So she was kind of a blank canvas at the point. She was writing with a harmonium, and so you could dress it up pretty much any way you wanted. The funny thing, every time we got together, every album that came up, there would be this one song that would show up. There was really pretty little melody, and very. I mean, it was a surprise every time. A very nice surprise.
Producing the Stooges, because that must have been something of a baptism of fire, I guess.
Actually, what I was concerned about with the Stooges was, having seen the show, the volatility of that show live, and how great it was, and the twisted emotions that go on through the show, and one minute you're being threatened, another minute you're being embraced. Yeah, I mean, really wonderful entertainment. How was I going to get that on a record?
Yeah, I guess.
And we had 10 days, whatever it was we were going to get on the record, we had 10 days. And the band came in, set up, slammed it. Then time to really do the vocals. He comes up to me, hands me a sheaf of papers. And I said, what's that? He said, the lyrics. And I said, whoa. And off he went, hit all the vocals. And we got on the mixing it. I mean, very professional.
Really?
Not too many takes. No, they were ready. They slashed. I mean, you can feel that kind of energy on the record anyway.
All right.
It's 1969, baby. It's 1969.
When it comes to producing, Brian Wilson is obviously a name that comes to mind. The Beach Boys is someone that you've talked about being a band that you love. What is it about them that speaks to your heart?
Well, apart from all the choral, the verse choral side of it, it's there was one song, and I really didn't put two and two together, that I heard on the radio once called In My Room. And then I realized the background to that story about taking a strap to and how this kid would run into the room and have his instruments, and that would be it. And that's kind of a heavy-duty image to have. And I, when they played at the Hollywood Bowl recently, I really wanted to go because I thought it was going to be a great concert. But I thought, if he's going to do In My Room, I'll probably lose it. So I don't want to do that in public.
You're listening to The First Time here on 6 Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, John Cale, founding member of the Velvet Underground, solo artist and producer extraordinaire. And that was the Beach Boys with In My Room, John's choice to illustrate the production genius of Brian Wilson.
6 Music.
6.
Come around and play, girl. Play.
I'm Matt Everett. Welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music. My guest today is John Cale, ex-Velvet's bassist and viola player, and now a solo star and an acclaimed producer in his own right. And that was Cleo, taken from John's first album, 1970's Vintage Violence. I asked him about the debut, which was more commercial and accessible than maybe you'd expect from someone with his avant-garde background. 1970 was your first solo album, Vintage Violence. Pretty accessible record.
Yeah, CBS was surprised. I mean, I think CBS was relieved.
But they're bracing for, like, what's
well,
going to come out?
They'd already heard Church of Anthrax.
Was that almost trying to intentionally surprise people by not doing something they'd expect that would be difficult, I guess?
No, I wanted to show to myself that I had the idea right.
When it comes to production again, I have to ask you about Patti Smith's Horses. How did you first meet her? How did you get involved with that record?
I knew about Patti in New York, even though I was this was 70s when I was doing Helen of Troy here. And the Worcester poetry group evenings were really sort of the usual group of rambunctious poets getting up or being late or deciding, you know, not to show up. You know, the kind of scene that was very funny and very energetic, and she was in there, and I remember. But they wanted to, there was a meeting that we had with Jane Friedman, the manager, and Patti. I don't know. It was a telephone call. I think a transatlantic telephone call. It sounded really... I mean, you can tell when you talk to Patti that there's this thing, this awe of language, you know. Isn't this language great? Look at what we can do with it, isn't it? You know, I love that. I mean, it's like this glow about...
A richness.
You know, a richness, yeah. Yes. And what is the rumble tumble and all? And she had that great rolling kind of parameters for her verses. So the thing was to go into the studio and try and maintain that. There was also that improvisational side of it that I really wasn't sure until she sat down and I said, now go and talk against yourself on this. Then I said, okay, now sit down and mix this the way you want the balance to be. And I really liked it. I mean, I think about it again. I wish you'd do that again because... you know, it always comes down to what in the melody and the counterpoint, anyway. So, where is the melody and the counterpoint in these lines? And each line that she writes is so intense, anyway. I mean, it's not the easy go lucky kind of. So, anyway, when that was done, I was as happy that there was something on the album that really set her apart.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me, me. People say beware. Me, I
Forward in the mid to late 70s, as kind of the punk rock movement started to gain a foothold, did you feel quite proud that maybe that was something that you either started or something that you could tune into?
I mean, the stuff that I was involved with, the viewers, the bass player or the viola player, as never the guitar player. So I felt a little on the outside, and then I started, you know, putting a band together and stuff. I couldn't play viola and sing at the same time. So it really was put me on the other foot. And the European tours that we did, a lot of guitar songs there. But the thing about those days where, you know, I could stand on my head and make up songs on stage with those guys, and they'd just be right there. They'd follow, you know what I mean?
Well, those shows have kind of, a lot of them have gone down as being pretty confrontational, I think is a good thing to say.
Yeah, but, you know, we'd go into clubs, and I would look at the club and I'd say, now, how do I make this show different from everybody else? Like, turn out all the lights, start the show with Close Watch, and turn it all the lights. And it said, there's an exit sign over there. It's on, turn that off. I said, no, I can't do that. It's a fire regular. Look, it's only for 3 minutes. You know, but it really got me to thinking about how to change the shape of the... And then there'd be the free-for-all of what, you know, if I had a riff that I wanted to play with, you know, let's start a song with that. I mean, it just, and a lot of that happened, and it was very exciting and very funny. Energetic times were really good.
From the late 70s into the 80s, you leapt from style to style with a great frequency. Sometimes there'd be very minimalist stuff, sometimes there'd be very kind of pop stuff, sometimes very electronic, sometimes almost kind of folky. Do you get bored? Do you get bored very, very quickly? Or is it, or are you pushing yourself intentionally to put yourself in positions that are maybe uncomfortable for you because you think it brings out the best?
Yes, I'm bored, and the best way to deal with that is to keep going and to work and work and work. The thing I'm guarding against it with every song is when I start a song and I create the shape and I think I know what it is and leave it until I do the final vocals and then go to the next one. The next one has got to be a different mood, different tempo, different, because I don't want to end up repeating myself and having to jettison a tune that I've been working on for like 5 days or whatever. So it's really a precautionary measure. It's also, I listen to KCRW every, you know, once in a while, and but I don't listen to a lot of radio because I don't want to find myself writing a hook that somebody, I mean, you can't be too careful in that.
She makes me so unsure of myself, standing there but never ever talking sense. Just a visitor, you see, so much wanting to be seen. She'd open up the doors and vaguely carry us away. It's the customary thing to say or do to a disappointed proud man in his grief. And on Fridays she'd be there, but on Mondays not at all. Just casually appearing from the clock across the hall. Here it goes, la 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 la. Here it goes, la 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 la. I'm the church, shall I come?
Moving on to more production stuff, tell me about working with the Happy Mondays, 1987. Because that's
it was a fleeting glimpse of a production.
It's another. You seem to be involved in lots of albums that seem to have acquired mythical status in some way or another, artistically and in the making of them. And that certainly seems to be one. Was it more wrestling a beast to the ground than it was?
Not really, but it was really wrestling a floppy ox. Octopus to the ground. It was so many moving parts all at once that you really, you know, you were lucky that, you know, that this just something happened and it was there and you got it done. And then it was a very short period. It was like a Stooges, you know, 10 days or whatever.
What attracted you to them?
Tony Wilson.
Right.
I mean, I really like Tony Wilson and what he was doing up there and his sensibility about all the, yeah, I mean, 24-hour party people is really excellent. You get that thing between Manchester and London, it's really good.
Watch it.
I want to ask you as well about a kind of song, a cover version that you did that's kind of become something different. In 1991, you covered Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
Right.
And your expression just kind of went serious there. Is this a song? What's your relationship like with this song now? Because it's become your version of the song, kind of has become, in many people's minds, the jumping-off point for every other cover of that wonderful song.
I just wish I had one penny for every... No, I'm going to call that right. just one penny!
What's your relationship with that song like now? Because, as I say, it's kind of become one of the definitive versions of a song that's been covered countless times.
When I got the lyrics from Leonard, I couldn't believe there were 15 verses there. And, you know, Les Rock put the session together for I'm Your Fan. So you can do 15 verses. And a lot of them, anyway, just totally inappropriate for me to sing about Yahweh and you know, religions here and there. And so I took the cheeky ones, you know, but the sexy ones.
You a big Leonard fan generally?
Yeah, he's meticulous. He's meticulous. I'm really glad he's doing well. He's such a laconic character.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. She broke your throne. She cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Baby, I've been here before. I know this room, I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you. I've seen your flag on the marble arch. Love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. 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 There was a time you let me know what's really going on below, but now you never show it to me, do you? I remember when I moved in you, and the holy dove was moving too, and every breath we drew was hallelujah. 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 To shoot at someone who outdrew you. And it's not a cry you can hear at night. It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
For someone that's constantly moving forward, you reformed the Velvets in 1993, which was very unexpected for many people. Why, and what was it like?
Well, I thought we could still do it. And with all the difficulties that we'd had, I thought Mo and Sterling, and really seeing how there was a bunch of new technology that made, you know, your sounds, at least you had a sound system that really benefited you, and you could really put that together.
Okay.
So I thought there was a good chance that we could do something again. And mainly what we could do again was improvise the way we did on stage, but that never happened. And slowly it became clear that the direction that Lou wanted to go in was different. I mean, the other guys were enjoying it so much. They were saying, oh, remember this song? You remember that song? What happened was it sort of derailed itself into that. You know, it was...
Into a predictable direction that you never wanted the band to be?
Well, it certainly walked away from the direction of we can do anything we want.
Hmm.
It now became, it became predictable. And being up on stage with you two, you know, in Naples, looking at a crowd that size, it was worth it for just, you know, watching the brawls happening in the air.
Hello, Cleveland!
Yeah. But, apart, you know, there were moments that were really touching, but most of the time it seemed to be... I don't think Lou was interested in having the band together. He just wanted to have the people there.
So we now got this new record, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Woods. First album in 7 years. So the other question I guess I have to ask, or else I'd be drummed out of music journalism school, is... Where is Nookie Wood? What is Nookie Wood?
You know what Nookie is, don't you?
Yeah, I know what Nookie is.
Right, well, this is the place that a lot of Nookie happens in arboreal circumstances.
Is this based on a specific place in your life?
Actually, it's a mixture of places that are really unpleasant. There's a place in Japan, an island, I think it is, where every holiday each year, people go there. And the police also know that when they go there at the end of the holiday, they're going to find a lot of people there have committed suicide. But anyway, that's not necessarily the Nookie Wood that's there, but I think when you hear the track, it's got darker corners in it.
The cooks have danced along the street, brewing up their bill of fruit.
And the final thing we have is we ask, I guess, to pick the final song. It can be anything you want, and we shall finish on that song that we should play.
Midnight Feast.
Why?
It's kind of my favourite song at the moment. It's because it travels. It takes you places. It really takes you on a journey. And it's kind of a femme fatale kind of that you've lost. You found her, and she wasn't in good condition then, but then... You got a little bit better, and then you lost her again, and then, but the journey continues. So something like that.
Journey continues.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Is BBC Radio
6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.
Against law, 5 years or more. Now she wants a score and a half hour draw. That's the kind of threat that you can't ignore. That put your pin down to the floor, but shut on foot, you said three match words. When that's the one for the buzz, when you said that, she forgot other ways. It's over, you better start buying the prayers. There was no intention of her being wife. Now she knows this, she's ending your life. It's a real shame you got half by the back. It's a shame that kid probably ain't yours. Yo, some bitch, you know.